Welcome to this episode of the Ghost Stories podcast. And yes, we are going to be talking about the budget, the South African budget. And goodness knows you've seen plenty of that in the media over the past few weeks. And we were kind of waiting for the dust to settle a little bit to see if anything changes and if anything else comes to the fore about how it's all going to get approved, et cetera, et cetera. And the headlines do keep flowing on what the process is going to be. And there's really been a lot of noise. So I think what's going to be great on this podcast is we're going to cover some of the just most important things that have kind of been in the headlines, have been a factor in this budget, and we have a genuine expert with us to do it. You've heard from him before. I think we did a budget speech podcast last year. So that is Tertius Troost. He is a senior manager in the tax consulting team at Forvis Mazars in South Africa. Tertius, thanks so much. It's great to have you back. Really enjoyed having you on the podcast previously, and I'm looking forward to getting your views on this budget speech and its aftermath, I think, because it hasn't quite been like it's been in the previous years, has it, where the thing just sails through. We are in a genuine environment now.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks so much for having me back. I'm looking forward to the chat again. I think last time I also said that during this time, tax people are rock stars. And once again, this one is a lot more tax focused than some of the previous ones. So there are many questions that have arisen from this budget. So yeah, looking forward to the chat.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, you'll never see tax in the headlines quite as much as at this time of year. And suddenly everyone wants to understand more about that and everything else. And it is, it's a very emotive thing. No one wants to pay more tax. Everyone wants to pay less tax. That is the great truth about all of us, really. But we need to fund the country. And that's, of course, where the balance comes in. And VAT has been the focus area of this budget. If we kind of look through everything, the war seems to be fought around VAT. For whatever reason, this is what was chosen as the hill to die on by the various politicians. So I think let's maybe start there and let's maybe just get an understanding of how important VAT is to the overall budget. How much money are we getting from VAT versus other sources, for example? Why is that so important?
Yeah, so VAT was definitely a significant focus of this budget. So just to understand the importance, I think, like I said, we need to look at the numbers. So VAT accounts for approximately 26% of the total tax revenue that SARS collects. So to put that in a number, SARS is expected, and their year end is the 31st of March coming up, to collect about 1.863 trillion rand in taxes. And of that, 477 billion is just from VAT alone. So this is the second highest contributor to the fiscus, only outshone by your personal income tax take, which accounts for about 40%. And then the final, which we usually refer to as the top three, is the corporate income tax, which accounts for approximately 16%. So that one takes third place. So when you look at those top three income streams, they account for 81.5% of all tax revenue. And this just shows how crucial VAT is in the budget component. Like I said, making up 26%, it's a significant sum.
And it's a bit easier to get a change across the line here because you're not introducing a new tax. You're just tweaking the rate. It's not like saying, oh, we're going to put a wealth tax in place and now, aside from the huge political fallout that is almost guaranteed, you're also going to have all the stuff around the legislation for what this tax looks like, and you need to amend the act, and then you need to think about how it interacts with all the other taxes. That doesn't happen overnight. But with VAT, all the legislation is there. It's literally just saying, well, you know, now the rate is a little bit higher, right? That's got to be one of the reasons why it's been a focus area as well.
100%. And it's like you say, it's an easy change. Businesses have gone through this back in 2018 when we had the change previously from 14 to 15%. So it's just systems that need to be updated. And then it pretty much pulls through to the economy. What's always interesting, it doesn't necessarily pull through immediately, but it does pull through over the course of time as prices increase according to the VAT rate increase.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you talk about, you know, how important VAT is. And I see this argument online a lot where people talk about, oh, this very small tax base in South Africa. We have a very small number of taxpayers supporting a lot of people. And inevitably, it is higher income earners who are trying to point that out because they're angry about the way government has been doing things. And they're saying, well, I pay a lot of tax. I'm supporting a lot of people. You know, why is it like this? And then one of the frequent or counter arguments that I see online is people saying, well, the definition of taxpayers is actually much broader than that because anyone who goes to the store and buys something through the formal market that they've paid VAT on is technically paying tax. Now, actually, both those arguments, I think, are correct, right? But the first person is arguing about income taxpayers, and the second person is saying, well, if there's a general uplift in economic activity and more people are buying stuff full stop, there are more taxpayers. So it's an interesting argument, but I guess the way to maybe unpack it a little bit more is to say, what is the concentration within the VAT base? Is it the same story where you see most of the VAT paid by a relatively small number of taxpayers? So you have almost the same problem you have in income tax.
Yeah, I actually read a very interesting statement in the budget review document. So this is a document that is released along with budget. It's quite a substantial document that has a number of how they will be spending, how they will be collecting the taxes. And one of the things that jumped out at me was that they state that 75% of the total tax collected is from the top four expenditure deciles. Now, maybe let's just take a step back, and what they refer to expenditure decile is where they divide the population into 10 groups based on their spending patterns. So in which each decile represents about 10% of the population, where they're spending from highest to lowest. So it might be obvious statement saying that, okay, but the more people spend, the more they contribute to VAT. But just looking at it and taking a step back and saying that 3/4 of all the VAT is collected from the top spenders, which usually equates to your top earners. It just once again points out that, okay, but we need to think about the wealthy in the country, and just looking at that tax base specifically, because they are still not only contributing in the form of personal income tax with higher rates, but also in their spending in indirect taxes. And I mean, indirect taxes like that, also aspects like transfer duty on home ownership. There are a lot of taxes that are collected in different forms. So it just talks again to this fact about it, even though the VAT rate does affect the poor, because they have less money to spend, they will get that, they will feel that pinch a bit quicker, the wealthy are just spending more, which relate to a bigger tax stack from them when it comes to VAT.
Yeah, not only are they spending more, but they're spending on taxable things, right? So if you think about the average, like on the breadline South African earning, you know, 6,000 Rand, 7,000 Rand a month doing one of the many jobs that can pay you that kind of number in South Africa, there's a very high proportion of that amount is getting spent on transport, which inevitably is taxis. Where there's, you know, you're lucky if there's income tax. I mean, there's definitely not any VAT. You know, then there's a lot of purchase of basic foods. There's inevitably payment of rent, which is often like a room in someone's house or that kind of setup. Again, no VAT. So, you know, of that amount, it's actually a very small proportion of that salary is being spent on VATable items, as opposed to when you go into middle class and certainly elite South Africa, you know, they're just paying VAT on most of what they're buying, actually, as opposed to such a small piece, right?
Most definitely. You're talking about taxes. I mean, the transport of people, it's an exempt supply. So there's definitely no VAT there. And rent, again, same story. So it is a fact that when you're looking at what people are spending on and what the wealthy are spending on, and if you look at the, once again, the zero-rated items, the wealthy don't necessarily just spend on zero-rated items. They spend on a range of things. So it definitely a much larger tax take from them.
Having said that, the zero-rated mechanism, it's good, but I mean, it doesn't also completely buffer the poor from the impact of this. And that's what's been interesting to see play out politically, is this VAT increase has very much been portrayed as anti-poor. I don't want to call it pro-rich, because no one wants to pay more tax. But if anything, it actually sounds like it hits the rich more than it hits the poor. You know, I think the difference is the poor literally cannot take on any additional pressure, whereas in a wealthy household, it's like, oh, you know, darn, our groceries are a little bit more expensive. We can't go out an extra time this month, you know, cry me a large river. But in reality, it is irritating for those people, and they are creating jobs, and they want to live in a country where they don't feel like they're being fleeced. So the cry me a river approach also very quickly leads to people immigrating and paying less tax and more pressure on the poor. You know, none of those approaches work. You've got to have a decent balance. But is the VAT increase actually anti-poor? You know, are there mechanisms that they're trying to get in place to actually sort that out? I mean, I've got to tell you, I don't hate the narrative purely because I want pressure on government to reduce spending. And I feel like the only place that pressure will come from is if their policies are seen as anti-poor. It feels like that's how it's going to happen. But, you know, be that as it may, how true is this and what are they doing to mitigate it?
Yeah, the narrative of VAT being anti-poor is a common one. VAT is a form of a regressive tax. So it does take a larger percentage of the income of lower income earners than high income earners. So in other words, the poor will definitely feel a VAT hike more quickly than the rich would. So that's probably why it has received this tag of being anti-poor. But this budget did try and alleviate some of the effect of the VAT rate increase by adding certain items to this zero rating list. But interestingly, in Treasury's own words, once again, this budget review document, the zero rating is sometimes what they refer to as a blunt tool, because when assisting low-income households, there's no guarantee that the price reductions will flow through to the actual consumer. But if I give an example, so we're looking at the additional items being added 1 May when the VAT rate increases slightly. But if you think about, retailers aren't going to drop the prices immediately with a 15% on, you won't see a 50% reduction on the shelf. There will be a period of some of the items maybe becoming slightly cheaper, maybe they're added to a special every now and then. So there will be a period of retailers actually taking a slightly higher profit until it settles in, until kind of your economics just flows through to it. And then at the same time, whenever you add items to a zero-rated list, the definitions of these items are extremely important. And there's always a very interesting case. It's actually a UK tax case way back in 1991, where the UK courts had to rule whether a Jaffa cake is actually cake or biscuits, just based on the definition. Because in the UK, cakes are zero-rated, but biscuits are subject to that.
That's hilarious.
It's quite interesting. Yeah, it's quite interesting. You're reading about learned judges having to debate the difference between cakes and biscuits.
I can just imagine on the witness stand, you're getting a baker in there. Yeah, and then, like, someone's granny who's been baking for 30 years. Like, she's got a strong view on whether this is a cake or a biscuit. Ask it, 10 toddlers. No, it's lovely.
And they're looking at aspects like, how does it look when it becomes stale? What's the shape? What's the size? Was it interesting?
That case. Must have been hysterical to follow.
But going back to South Africa, if we've actually seen the draft legislation of the items that they're looking to add. And initially in the budget speech, the minister alluded to zero rating canned vegetables, which is like a broad statement. But when we look at the actual legislation, it seems to be limited to only peas and beans that are in cans. So once again, that definition gets it, it's much narrower than we initially thought. And then at the same time, when we're looking at the other item added of offal, and we know that the chicken industry have been lobbying Treasury tirelessly trying to get chicken added to the list. But now we've got this where chicken, only the heads, feet, and giblets of chickens are added. But at the same time, something like that within a soup mix is excluded from the zero. So it's still subject to that. So these definitions are so important, and you will find that all businesses will try and get in them, trying to make their items more cheap, like, or just getting the items slightly cheaper and thereby increasing sales. But it is a very interesting space when you look at these definitions of the zero rated list.
Yeah, look, this government has a dubious relationship with Woolworths cooked chickens, so we'll wait and see if they do anything specific there. I don't think we're going to see a zero rating on chickens for the rich, unfortunately. But it is super interesting. And of course, why they have to be so careful is because of the possibility of VAT fraud, right? I mean, that's the magic of zero rated items. You can still claim VAT if you are producing that stuff versus exempt. Scratching back in my brain now for my varsity days on tax. It's been a while.
Well done.
But I mean, that's the risk, right? So if you can claim that what you are selling is zero rated, you can suddenly have a very different life, And as to your point, it doesn't mean you're putting your prices down. It just means you're not necessarily paying across any VAT anymore on the same selling price.
You're 100% right. A zero rated item means that the input VAT, so the expenses that you incur in order to produce the product, you can still claim those. And usually that can result in a form of refund because you don't have any output VAT when selling the item. So that's where most retailers want to be, or wholesalers or producers want to operate in. I won't necessarily say it's fraud. I think it's just sometimes it's a very, looking at the definition and trying to get as much into it as possible because of the benefit attached to it. And it can lead to higher admin costs by SARS now needing to close certain loopholes, or they have certain court cases trying to just bed down these definitions. Usually in the past, the definitions, I think initially back in 2018, we had a list of 19 items or so. And it was pretty clear what they were. They're just basic foodstuffs. But now as they're adding items, like, you can see how people start interpreting. I mean, another very interesting, and this was in last year's budget, they mentioned that we know that fruit and vegetable is zero rated. But then we have, if you go, you were talking about Woolies earlier. If you go to Woolies, you sometimes get vegetables that have been chopped up and they're in a little bag and you just cut off the corner and you give 2 minutes and it steams and it's perfect. But that's actually prepared vegetables. And then SARS said, but we don't want prepared vegetables in that list, and they would actually remove that out of the list. So now you're going to have a case where it's fruit and vegetables are still zero rated, but then if they've been chopped slightly or have some form of little dressing on it, then it's subject to that. So it is a very interesting space.
Yeah, it is. So I think let's move on from that for now. I mean, our parents warned us about a lot of creeps in our lives and staying away from them. But unfortunately, bracket creep is the one we can't get away from. And this is an income tax problem. And this is the one that hits the middle class, I think, the hardest. And this is basically just the complete lack of inflationary increases in the tax bracket. So for those who don't understand it properly or maybe aren't familiar with it, your income tax works on a sliding scale. And obviously the next tax rate, and by the way, people make this mistake all the time. They say, oh, I'm going into a new tax rate now. I'm actually going to earn less even though I'm earning more. It's like, no, the incremental amount will be taxed at the higher rate. You're not suddenly worse off because you got a raise from your boss, so calm down. But what should happen every year is the brackets, the point at which a specific tax rate comes in, should be going up by inflation. Because otherwise what's happening over time is you're getting increases in all likelihood. And so your effective tax rate actually just keeps going up, you know, on that salary, because you just are not getting any relief. What should happen is if you just get an inflationary increase, you should not be paying a higher overall tax rate. You should just be sitting in the brackets the way you always have been. It's a very, very, very stealthy way for the government to keep taxing us more and more. And I mean, this impact becomes severe over several years, right? I mean, you've looked at this as well. I can see why government loves doing it, because it's a very sneaky way to keep increasing taxes.
Yeah, I think as you mentioned, when bracket creep was first introduced, when they first did it, it was a very stealthy way of increasing tax revenue. And many of us in industry had to sit down and really understand the impact and how we're going to explain it to the public, because it takes the concept of inflation into account, which is sometimes not understood by all. I think we generally understand that. So I think if I take a very basic example, and please ignore all kind of tax principles, it's just like using 100 Rand. Don't come at me about with rebates. But if we use, let's say you earn 100 Rand last year and you pay 30 Rand in tax, you've got 70 Rand left for your normal living expenses. Now, some of the misconceptions might be, let's say it's a year later, there's been bracket relief, no relief on the tax brackets, and you still earn 100 Rand. That means the tax is not more, it's still 30 Rand, and you still have 70 Rand after tax money to spend. But what you have found is that all the things that you're spending your money on has increased due to inflation, and therefore you're in a worse position. And therefore you would have wanted to have your tax tables take that into account, so that when you have your after tax money, you're actually in the same position in a case where you, for example, don't get any increase in your salary. Obviously, as you get increase in salary and there's no increase in tax rates, it ends up with something on your effective tax rate. And that's where, if you run the numbers, let's say just take a very basic amount of someone that earned 200,000 Rand back in 2015. If they were to increase, if the tax that they would have paid at that date would have been effective tax rate of 12.1%. Now, I did the calculation on the site, you don't have to. And then if we take that and we just increase their salary by inflation, that means 10 years later, now in 2025, they should be earning about just shy of 320,000 Rand a year. And that means they're in the same position as when they were 10 years ago. But all of a sudden, the tax take of the effective tax there is 14.65%. So there's been an increase. And that's the effect that bracket creep has on the actual people paying personal income tax.
Yeah. Exactly. As you say, there's two ways to understand it. One is you get these inflationary increases and hence your average tax rate goes up. The other way, which is interesting, is to say if your salary stayed exactly the same, then if there was relief in the brackets, you'd actually have more take-home pay as a result. But because there's no relief, you don't. So yeah, very effective little trick there by government. They love it. And I doubt we're going to see it going away given where South Africa's fiscus is. So, you know, bracket creep is going to be creeping around the corners for a long time, unfortunately. So we've done VAT, we've done a little bit of income tax. The other thing I want to ask you about is corporate tax. I mean, we've been at a higher rate before. I remember when the rate dropped, you know, it was several years ago. Isn't it easier to just lop another 100 basis points on top of the corporate tax rate to take us back to where we used to be? Or is our corporate tax rate actually quite onerous benchmarked against other countries, and that's why it's a difficult one for them to do? Because that feels like one of the easier ways to do it, right?
Yeah, I mean, similar to the VAT rate increase, a change in the corporate tax rate is once again just a change in a rate. So it is easy to administer. But in an environment where globally most countries are actually reducing corporate income tax rates, trying to attract investment, it would not be wise to increase it at all. Another thing that stood out once again in the budget review document is that South Africa is ranked 13th of 123 countries when it looks at the share of corporate income tax rate to the share of GDP. So it's highly reliant on the corporate income tax rate, where other countries actually don't rely on that so much because they just want people to invest there, bring people there, get taxes and other forms of personal income tax or VAT, and actually don't rely on corporate income tax rate that much. So yes, it's and the other aspect that South Africa needs to bear in mind is our corporate income tax rate or collections from it is very volatile because it is heavily dependent on commodity price cycles, as you are well aware, and just economic growth, which we've not been seeing in the past number of years. So no, increasing that rate is definitely non-starter, something that they should not be looking at.
Dare I say, it's a pro-growth policy there to not increase that rate. Imagine seeing a pro-growth policy. No, it's cool. That makes a lot of sense, and it is good to see. And those are very good arguments, you know, because if you are encouraging investment, that's creating jobs, that's more people paying PAYE, it's more people buying stuff and paying VAT. And that's exactly the multiplier effect that you need to see coming through the economy. And that's where we've been lacking, unfortunately. So I think in these sort of budget speeches and actually in anything in life, you often learn as much from what was not said as from what was actually said. So as we start to bring this to a close, what were the deafening silences for you in this budget speech? What was not said?
Yeah, it's one of the items I really like looking at, what was left unsaid. And what I always find interesting is there's never a word about NHI. In the run-up to budget, in periods outside of the actual budget speech, you'll always hear the Minister of Health talking about NHI and how it's going to be implemented. But when it comes to the actual figures, you don't read a single word of it because it can't be afforded by the fiscus. What was even more alarming is we, once again, about probably 3 weeks prior to the budget, there was this whole, the media was talking a lot about this transformation fund, 100 billion that they're going to get from another levy on corporates. But when it came to the actual budget speech, there was literally not a single word stated about that. Because once again, you can't levy, a levy is a form of tax. So you're going to be just taxing your corporates again. And once again, as I've just stated previously, we can't afford that. And then we had during the time between the initial budget in February and then the actual budget in the 12th March, that some were alluding to, well, is Treasury maybe looking at a wealth tax? And we know that the problems we have with the wealth tax, just the definitions that would be how to value certain private companies, what it would do to your actual tax base. Maybe you find that your high earners would then leave the country. You've seen internationally that many countries that had a wealth tax actually did away with it. So once again, a non-starter, no mention of that in the budget. And finally, there was a number of rumors about the relationship between the finance minister and the commissioner, Edward Kieswetter. And it seems fine. I mean, Edward Kieswetter wanted additional funding, saying that he could obtain significantly more from the tax base. But I think the figures that he made were just quite remarkable. I don't think it's really achievable. But it was, once again, nothing was stated about there. I think the relationship is sound. They're each working on their own part, one with policy and one with administration and collection. And I think it's just that everyone keeps to their lane and does their job is what the country requires.
Yeah, hot mic incidents aside, I remember seeing those headlines. That was a bit of an awkward one. It has been a very interesting budget speech process. I mean, this GNU is playing out, right? I mean, that's what's changed. We've seen it's just not so easy anymore. Government can't just wake up and do whatever they want. And certainly from my side, what I hope to see is that instead of continuously trying to just get more money, that there's actually some introspection around spending cuts and actually finding places to save money. And this is where I want to just finish off on this podcast. I mean, what is quite interesting to think about is, you know, we talk about the public sector wage bill and the number of people who are employed by government. Of course, the funny thing is that government is paying them a gross salary and then immediately collecting a piece of that back as tax. So the impact to the fiscus is actually their net salary, not their gross salary, unless you assume that if they weren't working for the government, they could immediately work in the private sector for exactly the same salary, and then government is no worse off. They're collecting the PAYE anyway. Now, that's a perfect world where private sector absorbs all these public sector employees at what they earn in the public sector. I am willing to go out on a limb here that that is not what would happen. I think we all know that is not what would happen. So actually cutting jobs in the public sector is going to miss some of that multiplier effect of paying someone a salary, they go out and spend, you get a piece back as VAT, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it would save money, but if, you know, a government employee is earning R1 million a year, it's not going to save R1 million to the fiscus. It's going to save significantly less than that. So we'll see how that plays out. But I wanted to get your views on just spending cuts, how to allocate them, what government should be thinking about. I think it's just a nice place to bring this to a close.
Yeah, I think when it comes to the public sector wage bill, people always think the public sector wage bill is like the person, some administrative person sitting behind a desk or someone that's sweeping the streets, and there are too many people doing that, or you want to cut those jobs. But you have to think much wider than that. If you think about, if you've been to a Department of Home Affairs trying to get an ID or passport, there are few people already doing that job, and you get frustrated with long lines. And if you keep cutting that, you're actually cutting people from those jobs, and you'll get, the service delivery will be worse. And that's the problem with just cutting on that space. I think what the public want to see is they want to stop wasteful expenditure. So where you hear about the headlines of money being spent on this trip, or this is not well managed, or they've built this stadium and for this much over budget. I think that's where the cost-cutting measures need to be focused on. And if that takes place, then we'll see a definite turnaround. That's where we're definitely hoping that the GNU will push this forward, that there's a stop in just bad spending, if I can call it that. It's not necessarily just cutting the public sector wage bill and just saying to people, no, you're no longer employed by government, but it's actually just using them more effectively. Yeah. And then just making sure that the money is spent well, as you said, pro-growth environment.
Yeah, that makes a world of sense. It's the wasteful expenditure. It's the corruption. It's the nonsense you see in procurement. It's all that kind of stuff. That's what we desperately need to sort out. So we will see if this budget gets approved. We will see what happens with the implementation of the VAT increase. And if it doesn't get approved and it's back to the drawing board, we might be doing another one of these on this budget. I mean, we might have to make this a whole season each time they change something, but maybe we'll see some certainty, maybe we won't. Either way, Tarsus, thank you so much for your time. It's been really fun to have you back on. And yeah, it's going to be an interesting year for you. It's going to be an interesting year for all of us, I think.
Brilliant. Thanks for having me. Cheers.
Ciao.